welcome to episode 3 of the Replacement Level Podcast. I'm Ross Carey. Thanks for listening. Thrilled to be joined right now by Jim Callis. Jim is the executive editor of Baseball America. You can give Jim a follow on Twitter at JimCallisBA. Jim, thanks so much for taking the time to join the podcast today.
I'm glad to be here, Ross. I always like talking baseball and specifically the draft. Always glad to do it.
Well, Jim, let's start at the beginning, I guess. Tell me what initially attracted you to baseball in the first place.
Just enjoyed playing it when I was a kid. When I was young, and I remember my grandparents lived on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and we'd go up there on vacation every summer. And my grandfather and my grandmother were both Red Sox fans. And I guess my grandfather, that's on my mom's side, probably was the person who maybe nurtured that love of baseball the most when I was a kid. I mean, we'd talk baseball, and I remember I had this dice baseball game that I loved playing when I was a kid, made by a company called Sherco. I don't even know if it still exists, but you rolled dice and you actually plotted where the ball went on this, like, I think it was like a 28 by 28 grid, and you would field dimensions on there, and then you'd make plays. And I'd actually write game stories. I loved to write at a young age, too. And I would write game stories, and I just remember my grandfather, encouraging me in that regard also.
That's great. I was one of those kids, too, that would create my own games. I would have my own, like, dice and playing card, deck of card combo, and I would create my own games, and I would have fictional players. I would track all their stats in, like, Excel spreadsheets. So I was a fellow baseball nerd, even as a kid.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I still have Sherco somewhere here in my house. It was a really cool game because, if you played at Fenway Park, it was shorter down the left field line, or if you had old Yankee Stadium, it was deeper, and so it wouldn't just be, home run or double. Ball might be caught in one park and a home run in the other, and made all these weird, it was a really, really cool game. And the cool thing about it, too, like you were saying, Ross, is you could adapt it also because they had a rating system that was pretty straightforward, and they showed you how to rate the players. So if I wanted to, I remember doing this, replay the 1947 World Series. I could take, I could either take how the guys did during the regular season or in the series in particular, and in like half an hour, rate the players on both teams and then play the series. So it was a lot of fun.
So when you decided to pursue journalism and a career in baseball professionally, why the focus on amateur baseball and scouting?
It's just kind of the way it evolved. I went to the University of Georgia. And the first year I covered the baseball team for the school paper was in 1987, and it turned out that was the first year that Georgia ever went to the College World Series. And, we had two first-round picks on the team, and Derek Lilquist and Chris Carpenter, one of the many Chris Carpenters in baseball. But we had another big leaguer on the team and an outfielder named Steve Carter. And I went to Omaha with the team and covered it and just kind of fell in love with the college baseball there. And at the time I was reading Baseball America, which was in about, its sixth year of publication at that point. I was into fantasy baseball, which was big, but not as big as it was today. And that was kind of a way, Baseball America was a way to read about minor leaguers. And it just interested me, here were players you didn't hear as much about, certainly compared to the big leaguers. And that just piqued my interest. And, just the way things worked out, I started working for Baseball America right out of school. And I was the college guy right off the bat and doing minor league coverage. And I just kind of started doing it then. And other than about a 2.5-year stint at Stats, Inc. up here in the Chicago area, when I moved up here with my wife, I've worked for Baseball America forever since. I've been at Baseball America, if you count a summer internship, for almost 25 years minus that 2.5-year period at Stats, Inc.
Well, 25 years is a long time, and I'm curious how, over the course of 25 years, we've seen the internet explosion, and we've seen new media, we've seen things like Twitter and everything else. How has new media changed scouting?
I think like anything else, not just scouting, just information's more readily available. I don't know if teams necessarily use the new media to scout. I think they use it to communicate, and I think they use it to follow news. Dylan Bundy, when he was off to a spectacular start at the beginning of the year when nobody in low class A seemed like they could get on base against him, you'd have people tweeting out pitch-by-pitch updates or tweeting out, hey, here's his line score, three more perfect innings. I know from a reporting standpoint, I mean, I guess I'm going to sound old now. I mean, when I started, there was no internet. There were cell phones, but few people had them, and those who did didn't necessarily want their numbers out. So, you had to try to track down guys in an office. Stuff wasn't reported immediately. You certainly didn't have the baseball package you can get on TV, or, you know, let alone your computer or smartphone, where you can watch games live on your cell phone. And back then, I mean, we had Baseball America had no website, there was no internet. And we had we came out every 2 weeks, and, if something happened the day after we went to print, we waited, we wouldn't necessarily wait 2 weeks to compile the story, but it would be 2 weeks before it appeared in our pages. There wasn't much we could do about it. Now, I mean, if something happens, like, for instance, we just got done reporting the signing deadline, which I've been doing, for most of the last month, is doing draft signings. If I'm at home and I get a text at 11:30 at night that a guy signed, I'm tweeting it out 2 minutes later and blogging it on our website. I mean, it's there's no delay in the news cycle. The news cycle is 24/7, and people not only want, I mean, they expect news when it happens. They don't expect to read about it in a morning paper or just wait for a magazine to show up in 2 weeks. So it's, I guess it keeps us on our toes all a lot more, because, you have to be prepared to find news and report news really at any time of the day.
Scouting has become such a broad term. It encompasses so much now. What kind of scouts are there? How many scouts does a team typically employ, and what are the different kinds of scouts?
Well, I mean, in terms, well, you have your pro scout. Well, I guess your pro scouts, international scouts, and amateur scouts, and there is some overlap. But your international scouts will scout, Latin America and the Pacific Rim and those countries. And your pro scouts, for teams that have separate staffs, is they'll divide up, minor league teams, the upper level minor league teams, and scout them for potential trades and to stay on top of things. You never know when you might be talking trade with a team, and you don't want to have to run out the last second and scramble to get reports on guys. You want to already have them. But from a draft standpoint, the teams divide the country up into areas, and they have area scouts. Where typically, they might have half of a big state like California, or they might have six or seven small states. It just depends on whatever region you're in. And I'd say the typical team, probably has, somewhere around 20 area scouts. Then above those guys, you have cross-checkers, who are kind of the more supervisory scouts. They'll come in and cross-check or double-check what the area scouts are finding. And some teams will have regional cross-checkers, where you might have one eastern, central, western. And then you might have a couple national guys who cross-check the whole country. And then above them, you'll have a scouting director. And some teams even have an assistant general manager in charge of scouting. So that's kind of how they set up the draft scouting staffs. And they're all theoretically doing the same thing. The area scouts are seeing more players. You won't, if you're a cross-checker, see everybody in the area. You'll see the best guys in the scouts area that you're going to take at the top of the draft. If you get to, the 20th round of the draft and you're drafting a guy, that might be a guy the area scouts guy likes that nobody else on your staff saw, or maybe one guy saw it. Whereas in the first round, the area scout will have seen that guy a lot of times, and so will your cross-checkers and your scouting director will have seen him multiple times. So it's, you can get a lot of looks at a guy you're going to take early in the draft. You might only get, one guy checking out a guy you're taking late.
Well, if you have a guy that you're looking at early, if you have him in your top 50 on your board, so you're looking at taking him in the first couple of rounds there, how many times is he actually being seen? How many games is this kid being seen? Are we talking about 5? Are we talking about 20? What are we talking about here?
It depends. Pitchers obviously, have fewer games than position players, but the higher the player, the more you see him. I mean, if I'm taking a guy, Ross, say at the top of the first round, a top 10 pick, I might, once we zero in on him, I'm probably having the area scout go to every one of his games and running cross-checkers and scouting directors and assistant GMs. Sometimes the GMs will take a look too. I'll probably have somebody just about every one of his games. Now, if it's a guy that I don't want teams to know I'm on, although I don't think there's a lot of secrets in scouting, I might try to hide my interest and maybe not attend some of those games. But, the guys who are going at the top of the draft, especially the very top, if I have the number one overall pick, I'm probably seeing that guy every chance I get.
This year, Major League Baseball installed a bunch of new draft rules. Let's talk about the significant changes. It seems like the biggest change came with the structure of money with the first 10 picks. What other changes and what was the intent behind them that Major League Baseball wanted to accomplish by implementing them?
Well, I think, Bud Selig will talk about parity, but the main thing they wanted to do was reduce spending in the draft. And I don't think they reduced it as much as they may think they did, but we can talk. We'll get to that in a minute. The big rule change was, in the past, you could spend whatever you wanted on the draft. Now, MLB would make recommendations on what you should spend on each pick, which were about 50% below market value and were kind of a joke, and they would try to cajole teams into going along with it, but teams would basically ignore them. They had these set procedures you had to go through if you wanted to ignore MLB's recommendations, and a lot of times you'd have players agree to deals, but the team couldn't announce it until right before the sign deadline because MLB didn't want anybody else to theoretically be affected by what got signed for. And you also had people got educated with the signing deadline in mid-August. Hey, the longer I, it gets to a point, the longer I wait, the more money I'm going to get. This year, with a bunch of changes with the CBA, they put limits on what teams could spend. As you alluded to, Ross, every pick in the first 10 rounds was assigned a value. And in retrospect, I've just spent the last week crunching numbers since the deadline on Friday and getting final signing reports. The numbers they assigned, for the most part, were pretty even, pretty equal to market value. They actually set them very high at the top to give the worst teams more spending power. And while the individual picks had value, you could pay what you wanted on those individual picks. But what they looked at in the end was that you add up all the money you have in the first 10 rounds for your individual picks, which ranged from a little bit over $12 million from the Twins, who had the second overall pick and some extra picks, to under $2 million for the Angels, who gave up their first and second round picks as compensation for Albert Pujols and C.J. Wilson. So in any case, you had these bonus pools, and you could spend as you saw fit with those pools. But if you went If you spent over your pool, you had to pay a tax on the overage, which isn't that big of a hindrance. But if you went 5% over your pool, which for the average team had about a $6.5 million pool, so you're talking only $325,000 over your pool, you'd lose a first-round pick. If you went 10% over, you lost a first and a second-round pick. And if you went 15% over, you'd lose two first-round picks. So essentially, and we saw this, we expected this, no team was going to give up a pick. There were teams that spent right up to the 5%, and there were 10 teams that will pay some form of draft tax. And the other 20 stayed, right under their bonus pools, at or close to them. And then they kind of took out loopholes that would allow you to manipulate it. If you didn't sign a guy, and I'm sure we'll talk about this guy more in a second, like the Pirates didn't sign the eighth overall pick in the draft, Mark Appel, and his pick was worth $2.9 million of their pool. Instead of being able to spend that money elsewhere, his money disappeared out of their pool. So their pool shrunk to about $3.7 million. If you could not, I mentioned the pools applied to the first 10 rounds. You couldn't just go crazy after the 10th round, because anything you spent on anybody after that point that exceeded $100,000, that would count to the pool. So if I wanted to try to give my 15th rounder $2 million, $1.9 million counted versus the pool. So it put a finite limit on what teams could spend, because nobody was willing, and I don't think anybody ever really will be willing, to sacrifice a first-round pick to go above and beyond their pool high enough to sign a player.
Is that a good thing? It's a general concept, limiting spending to, American-born players who are eligible for the draft. When you see the international players, at least prior to this year, you look at Chapman and you look at Alexi Ramirez and Cespedes, those guys all went to teams. They got a lot of money, a lot more money than first-round picks and elite-level players get in the draft. You would think that if Bryce Harper were simply a free agent or didn't have restricted spending, a prospect like that would get much more money than is being allowed.
Yeah, there's no question. And the draft is, if you're comparing the draft to the international process, the draft is more unfair to players. There are now restrictions on what you can spend internationally, but those guys are free to negotiate for now. I think we will get an international draft in the next few years, but for now they can negotiate with every team, and so they have more freedom. In the draft, you can only negotiate with one team. And you're right, Bryce Harper, Steven Strasburg, two examples from recent drafts. Even Gerrit Cole last year. Last year was a loaded draft. These guys would have gotten $30, $40 million as well. I prefer a laissez-faire approach. I think you should let teams spend what they want. I think the biggest bargain in player acquisition is the draft compared to international free agents. I'm talking about amateurs or major leaguers. It's a bigger bargain than signing major league free agents. It's the best way to rebuild. And it was an arena in which small revenue teams could spend whatever they want. The Pirates could outspend the Yankees. The Pirates spent $17 million on their draft in 2011. This year, the Pirates' bonus pool was their bonus pool was $6.6 million, and because they didn't sign Mark Appel, they only spent $3.8 million total on the draft. That's a huge hit on the Pirates. There were some nice side effects of this year's draft in that players signed a lot quicker. You didn't have to go through this goofy process where MLB wouldn't let teams announce signings of players. Teams initially feared that this might make it harder to sign high school players, and that proved untrue. They signed more high school players this year, even though they paid them a little bit less on average. The same number of top-tier and second-tier high school players signed as they did in the past, so it didn't affect that. You know, and in the end, you know, bonus spending went down from, you know, last year teams spent $236 million on the draft, including about $8 million in salaries and big league contracts, which as part of the new rules, you can no longer give to draftees. And this year they spent $208 million. And so that's a $28 million decrease. So I'm sure in the commissioner's office, they're saying, this is great. We just saved $28 million on the draft. But the thing was that I think it's overlooked a little bit, Ross, is this year's draft was mediocre. And last year's draft has the potential to be one of the best drafts of all time. I mean, last year you had seven guys who probably would have been the number one pick in this year's draft had they been in this year's draft. And they all won the top seven picks, and they signed for a combined $47 million. Well, this year the top seven picks, well, they're good players, weren't that good, and they signed for $29 million. So that's a, you know, you walk through the math with me, that's an $18 million decrease just on the top seven picks. Well, once you take that out maybe to equalize the difference in talent between the drafts, which, you know, extended beyond the top seven picks, but let's just say it ended there, they only saved really $10 million on the draft this year. And that's, you know, $333,000 per team. And in the end, I don't think that's worth, you know, making it that much harder for the Pirates or the Royals or these small market teams that spent big money in the past, you know, now can't spend on the draft, you know, unless they're picking one or two and have a huge budget, because it's just the penalties for spending that much now are just too great.
Well, let's talk about Mark Appel a little bit. He's the pitcher from Stanford. I guess many people thought he was the best player in the draft or thought he would go number one overall. He's also represented by Scott Boras. I think a lot of people were wondering if Boras was going to find some sort of loophole to the system. Is there a loophole here? Do you see anything that could have been done outside of Appel returning to school?
No, I mean, there is no loophole. I mean, people have floated in the past, and this came up when Boras was advising Strasburg, you know, maybe you take a guy to Japan, and then you get the Japanese team to agree to make him a free agent after a year. But the problem with that is, one, I don't know why a Japanese team would want to help a player circumvent the U.S. draft. And it's not like Mark Appel's good. I mean, Mark Appel's good, but it's not like he's going to make a Japanese team win the championship over there all by himself. And two, MLB would still rule that you know, that guy would have to re-enter the draft. There is no loophole. You know, by making the money disappear if the guy doesn't sign, by not allowing you to just go crazy after the 10th round, there is no loophole to get a guy paid. And, you know, the thing you could have done, it's not a loophole, you know, what the Pirates could have done, and, you know, it's unclear what Mark Appel's magic number would have been. There are reports that the Astros offered him $6 million. There are also reports that that's not true. The Appel camp disputes, you know, says that never happened. Yeah, but that rumor won't go away, that he was offered $6 million. So let's say his number was 6.5. Well, that was pretty much the whole Pirates bonus pool for the first 10 rounds. And if they were willing to pay tax, you know, which they were, they offered him as much money as they could without paying tax, you know, they could get another $300,000. So theoretically, the Pirates could have taken Mark Appel and then taken a bunch of college seniors with all their picks after that in the first 10 rounds and signed those guys for about $5,000 each and then given all their whole bonus pool to Mark Appel. But the problem is, if you do that, one, your whole draft's riding on one player, even if he's good. And Mark Appel is good. He's good. He's not great. He's not Strasburg. He's not Gerrit Cole. He's not that type of guy. And two, unless you have an agreement, you know, which is technically illegal, but teams do all the time, unless you know that Mark Appel is going to sign for that number, then you're letting Mark Appel hold your whole draft hostage. So, you know, what it came down to was the Pirates weren't going to put all their eggs in Mark Appel's basket. They drafted other – in rounds 2 through 5, they drafted guys who belonged in rounds 2 through 5. They had a supplemental first round or two. Rounds 6 to 10, they took guys they could sign cheap, and they basically created an extra $700,000 they could give Mark, and they were willing to go another – you know, to pay some tax, you know, without losing the draft pick, so they'd go up to 5% over their cap. So they had a $2.9 million pick value on Mark Appel, and they got to where they could offer him $3.8 million you know, without having to lose a draft pick, which in the end didn't get it done. I still like the move, Ross. I think his upside when you're picking 8, you know, that's a guy who probably should have gone the top 3 picks. I think it was worth it because from the Pirates' standpoint, you don't lose that much. You get the number 9 pick in next year's draft as compensation, and it's protected. So even if they don't sign that pick, they'd get the number 10 pick in the 2014 draft. And, yeah, you know, you'd rather sign the guy now, but I do think Appel's talent was worth gambling on. But, you know, and they do, like I said, it's low risk. You get a comparable pick in next year's draft. You know, Appel, you know, I right now he's the number one prospect for a mediocre 2013 draft. I think there's a good chance he goes higher. And even though he'll have less leverage, he may even get a little bit more money, you know, depending on how that plays out. We'll see. You know, I mean, he has to continue doing what he's been doing. And if he slips in performance or got hurt, obviously, then he's going to take a huge hit. You know, the question is, to me, Ross, is even if he signs for, you know, let's say he gets more than 3.8 next year, whatever the number is, he delayed his career a year. You know, he may have delayed his arbitration and free agent eligibility a year. So even if he gets a bigger bonus next year than he would have gotten this year, I'm not so sure that that's still like he comes out ahead in the long run. I don't begrudge him his decision. I mean, that's obviously his decision not to sign. I would have, you know, had I been his advisor, I would have told him to sign for the 3.8, but, you know, he opted not to.
I agree. I mean, from the outside looking in, you look at that and you say, look, $3.8 million is a lot of money. Maybe he felt he was worth double that, which I suppose is reasonable when you look at what the number one picks had gone for before this new system had taken in place. But if you're a pitcher, and especially a pitcher, injuries happen all the time, and Tommy John happens. While taking Appel wasn't really a risk by the Pirates, not signing is a huge risk by him. He is going into the year, as you mentioned, as the number one prospect, and he might go number one overall, but he might get hurt. He might really hurt himself here. And it seems like, just as you mentioned, getting in a pro system sooner, starting that free agent clock sooner, seems to be a much better thing. It seems like in this particular case, I don't know if this was ego getting the best of Boris. I don't know what happened here.
The tough thing is, I mean, you know, like I said, everybody's got this. I would have thought, I would have signed, but I'm not Mark Appel and I'm not Scott Boris. You know, that's his decision. And I know there's some Pirates fans who bury a will to him now. And I think that's silly. At the same time, you know, it's funny because I can kind of look at this two ways. One, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, the tough thing is with this system is, Mark Appel's worth as a pitcher, I'm not talking about mantra, I'm talking about value on the field, is constant whether he goes number one to the Astros, number eight to the Pirates, number 31 to the Yankees. His worth as a pitcher is still the same. It's just you can pay him dramatically less the lower he goes. And so that's kind of a tough concept if you're the player to wrap your head around. But on the other side of that is, you know, Scott Boris is a tremendous agent and gets a lot of money for a lot of players. But, you know, if you're Mark Appel and the Appel family, and you choose Scott Boris and the Boris Corporation as your advisor, you know that sometimes this type of thing happens. And sometimes Scott's guys fall because people are concerned about what they're going to sign for. And I can't confirm 100% either way whether the Astros did or did not offer him $6 million. But for whatever reason, everybody thought Appel was going number one until about, you know, an hour or two before the draft. I'm not talking just about draft prognosticators and people who cover it like me. I'm talking about teams. Everybody thought Mark Appel was going number one, and something happened. And again, I'm not blaming anyone, but, you know, there are concerns a lot of times about Boris Corporation's players' signability. And if you go that route, then, you know, sometimes that's what you're in for. So, you know, they made their decisions, and, you know, they're obviously decisions they're free to make, and, you know, we'll see how it turns out. I really would not be surprised. I mean, I if I had to bet as of today, right now, Ross, I think he will go higher in next year's draft, and it wouldn't surprise me if he got more than $3.8 million. But whether or not waiting a year to get whatever that number is, you know, we'll see whether that really pays off in the long run.
Over the past 30 years, baseball has lost a lot of multiple sport athletes to basketball and football. Do the new draft rules help major league teams sort of lure away the multiple sport stars, or does this hurt them?
You know, I don't think it really has an effect. I mean, you can still pay guys. If you draft guys high enough, you can still pay them a lot of money. You know, and I mean, this year's draft, the guy who is supposed to be unsignable was Anthony Alford, who told teams he was definitely playing, you know, football at Southern Miss, and the Blue Jays wanted to take him in the third round and giving him $750,000 basically to have baseball as a summer job. They're going to let him keep playing football. I think where baseball loses athletes to other sports is when they're very young. You know, football and basketball, you know, get a lot more attention, especially at the grassroots level, than baseball does. You know, you got your AAU stuff for basketball, all these youth-based basketball programs and, you know, youth football programs get a lot more glory and TV coverage and press than baseball does, and I think it attracts kids. I think from a college standpoint, those sports obviously get a lot more coverage than baseball. There's a lot more scholarships for those sports, you know, player for player, than there are in baseball, and I think that's where baseball is losing them. I don't think the draft rules are, you know, they may affect an individual guy here or there, but it, you know, they're losing those athletes to other sports, you know, well before the draft.
well before the draft, and in many cases, it's well before high school. They're because of AAU and because that you see these lists from scouts.com, they're ranking the top high school kids in football and in basketball. That's a huge thing. They have junior high lists as well. These kids in basketball, they seem to know when they're going to be superstars when they're 13 years old, and they just focus on basketball only.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the specialization, Ross. If you're a top caliber athlete and you're playing for top caliber youth programs and summer teams, those coaches want you to pick their sport. They don't want you, some of these guys could be obviously elite athletes in multiple sports, but a lot of times you're forced to pick at a very young age.
We obviously have seen this year some of the changes that MLB wanted to install in the draft. What changes would you make in the draft?
Well, I mean, if I were in charge, if I could just make any draft rules I wanted, I, for the most part, would make no draft rules. I would let teams spend what they want, when they want, and not worry about it. If we had to operate in the framework of the current system, and let's say instead of being appointed the czar of the draft, I was allowed to only make a couple tweaks. The one thing I thought was goofy, the one thing I wouldn't be able to change in that regard, I guess, is letting small revenue teams spend whatever they want. But the one thing that got really goofy with this year's draft that would be great if they could address somehow was, because these bonus pools encompass the first 10 rounds, you had a lot of teams to create money, and it's a good strategy. I would have done the same thing. Like the Blue Jays, for instance, took all college seniors from rounds 4 through 10 and signed them for $5,000. And I think, I don't have the number in front of me, but I remember looking, round 7 through 10, 120 picks, more than a third of those guys were college players who had no eligibility left, who had no bargaining power, were going to sign for $5,000 here or $1,000 there, $10,000, so you could save the money. And it really, those rounds were not a reflection of talent in many cases. It was a reflection of, hey, who has no leverage that we can sign for next to nothing and use his money. So I think what I might do, if I had to keep the current system but I was allowed a small tweak here or there, maybe you assign the bonus pool to the first 5 rounds. You maybe give them a little extra money. You sign the bonus pool to the first 5 rounds, and then everybody after the 5th round has a $100,000 limit, and if you go over that, it counts against your pool. Because then, then I think you would see the draft, more so than it was this year when you got to round 6 through 10, reflect the players who belonged in those rounds rather than just, hey, here's a guy we can sign for $1,000, so let's take him and move on. That would be if I had to operate under the current framework and I can't just rip up all the rules and let teams do what they will, that would be the change I would make.
Why can't teams trade draft picks either before the draft and during the draft?
We are going to have a change in that regard coming up now. We have a competitive balance lottery, and that's going to be held Wednesday. That will result in 6 picks after the first round and 6 picks after the second round. And those 12 picks can be traded. Those will be the only 12 draft picks that can be traded. And they can only be traded, oddly enough, during the regular season but not the off season. But to get back to your general question there, I think it's basically because baseball is slow to change. And when they started the draft, they didn't have trading of draft picks. And so they've never had it. It got to the point where baseball realized, after losing a couple grievances, they can't make changes to the draft rules without the union's approval because they're tied into free agent compensation. And I think even now, it would definitely create more interest in the draft, but you still have a split among, when I talk to people in baseball, there are some people who would like to see trading a draft picks, Ross, because they think, not so much that it would create interest, but that would give a team more options. Let's say you're picking somewhere, like, for example, maybe the Pirates knew they weren't going to, be able to sign Appel, or it was a long shot to sign him. Maybe there's a team picking lower in the draft that would say, hey, well, we'll give up a lot to move up to your number 8 slot, and then we can have the money, to maybe go get Mark Appel when we add him to the rest of our draft. You have a team, if you got to a point where you didn't love a player on the draft board, you could trade for a minor leaguer who could help your team quicker. So there are people who think it would give you more options in how you build your team. But at the same time, Ross, you have other people who think it would be terrible because it would allow agents to manipulate the draft. We talked about Bryce Harper before. Bryce Harper, when he's on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he's in high school, talked about, one day he wants to play for the Yankees and be part of that great tradition. Well, I mean, what if Bryce Harper tells the Washington Nationals, who had the number one pick in 2010, I want to be a Yankee. And Bryce had a lot of leverage because he was a junior college player, 17 years old, who could have reentered the draft the next year at 18. And what if Bryce told teams, whoever the number one pick, hey, I want to play for the Yankees, so if you don't trade me to the Yankees, I'm not going to sign. Then you have players manipulating exactly where they go. I don't know if we'll ever see widespread trading of draft picks because you still have a lot of disagreement over whether it would be good or bad. I do think, it's kind of a trial balloon with these 12 competitive balance lottery picks that will be traded. But I'm not even sure if we'll see those dealt, Ross, because the bonus pools, you know, like I said, average $6.5 million per team. And if I get a supplemental first round competitive balanced lottery pick, that might add about, you know, $1.5 million to my bonus pool. And that's worth a lot. I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't think teams are going to be looking to trade those picks.
I want to mix it up a little bit because I'm curious as to how aware college coaches should be about overusing their players, specifically pitchers. I think there was a game where Mark Capel pitched over 140 pitches in one start this year. I don't think any major league pitcher has thrown that many pitches in a start this year. And I'm curious if you, obviously the coaches at Stanford are concerned with their own team and their own program. They're not affiliated with Major League Baseball. But when you have a prospect who you know is at least going to get drafted, who you know is going to be a high-level draft pick, do you have to be more cautious with them? Should they be considering his pro career when they're making decisions about his college status as well?
They are, and I think coaches do. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and defend every coach, how they handle every pitcher, but, you know, it's not, I mean, with Mark Capel, it's not like he threw 140 pitches week in and week out. And one thing I caution kind of when people look at pitch counts is one, I mean, there are some people who think by not stretching guys out, letting them throw more pitches, it doesn't build up their arms enough, and that contributes to them getting hurt. But the thing is, a pitch at the college level is not the same as a pitch in the minors or a pitch at the major league level. You know, college pitchers pitch once a week, not once every 5 days. It's less taxing. The competition you're facing is less strenuous than you would in the major league. So I'm not advocating throwing your college pitchers 140 pitches, but at the same time, I don't think that's the same as a major league pitcher throwing 140 pitches. I do think, you know, you can, if you look at sheer pitch counts, there you'll see things here and there and wonder, okay, you know, seems like a lot of pitches. You know, why are they throwing that many pitches? But at the same time, you know, college coaches, if you were to be running pitchers into the ground and getting, you know, quality prospects hurt, you're going to get destroyed on the recruiting trail. So, I mean, you know, and obviously, too, I mean, I'm not even getting to, you know, teams have, you know, an affection for their players, too. I mean, it's not just wins and losses, and we don't want to lose recruits. I mean, Stanford doesn't want to see Mark Capel get hurt. You know, LSU doesn't want to see Kevin Gossman get hurt, and so on and so on. So, you know, these teams do have incentives to do handle guys carefully and monitor that stuff. And, you know, yeah, I mean, do things happen that if I'm a pro team, I probably wish the guy threw fewer pitches from time to time? Yeah, but I do think teams monitor that stuff. And I don't think I know when I first started covering college baseball in the 80s, it seemed like you'd have guys, you know, start on Friday and relieve on Sunday and maybe pitch in the middle of the week. I think teams are much more cognizant. College programs are much more cognizant of trying to keep an eye on those things than they were 20, 25 years ago.
What do scouts overvalue most?
I don't know if I'd say if overvalue is exactly how I'd put it, but I mean, I think it's very easy to overproject a guy that you like, you know, cause especially a high school player or, you know, or even a college player. I mean, you're not drafting these guys based on what you're seeing today. I mean, that's part of it, but you're drafting them based on what you think they're going to become. And I think a lot of times, like, you know, with high school players, especially, they're 18 years old. They're probably 5 or 6 years in a lot of cases away from the major leagues. It's easy to think, okay, this guy's throwing 90, he's going to throw 93. Or, okay, this guy, you know, has some rough edges as a hitter, we're going to polish that up. And then that stuff does happen. Guys do get better. But there are guys, you know, who are 18 or 21 years old and starring at that level who don't get any better than they currently are. And I don't think there's any magic formula for that. You know, I think that's the tough part. I mean, you can look at things like a guy's swing and a guy's arm action and his body type and project that type of thing out. But at the same time, I mean, you're still looking in the crystal ball. And, you know, when you're making, you know, you're doing that much projection that far down the road, you know, there are going to be times when you aren't right.
I wonder if bloodlines, because Bonds and Griffey ended up being so good, if heritage, if your dad played, if you have a sibling that played, if that's one of those things that gets overvalued now.
I don't know if it gets overvalued. I mean, I don't think you see anybody go in the, you know, say top 5 rounds of the draft, you know, get really overrated because of their bloodlines. I mean, I think it'll get you an opportunity. If you had two players and one guy had blood, you know, who were equal to his prospects, and one guy had bloodlines and one guy didn't, you wouldn't. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I could think of a guy like D. Gordon, you know, whose dad, you know, son of Tom Gordon, who had very little baseball experience, didn't play in a spring into junior college because of a transfer snafu. And, you know, he wound up being a 4th-round pick. And at the time, everybody's like, who is this guy? And now D. Gordon's already in the big leagues. I mean, there are an awful lot of guys with bloodlines who, you know, do pay off. But again, I agree with you though, Ross. I mean, I think you have to look at it in context. I mean, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. was a great player. Craig Griffey, not so much. You know, he got a chance. I mean, he didn't get anywhere near the attention and wasn't a high pick like Ken Griffey Jr. was. But, you know, just because you have bloodlines, it's not automatic. But, you know, if you have a prospect who's a pretty good prospect and he does have bloodlines, I do think there's something to be said for counting that as a point in his favor.
Why do some or so many elite prospects fail?
I think it's just because you're projecting them so far down the road. And it's funny you bring that up because I get this question a lot, and I always say the same answer. And I still haven't done it yet. I'm not so convinced that, you know, even though you're projecting the guys further than you are a basketball or a football player who step right into the NFL or NBA lineup, I'm not so convinced that the failure rate of, say, first-round picks in baseball is that much different than NFL or the NBA. But I think the difference is a lot of the first-round picks that fail in baseball don't make it to the major leagues because they don't make it through the minors. But, you know, you have your Jamarcus Russells, you have your Michael Olcondes, you know, you have any number of huge draft busts in the NBA and NFL. They just have already gotten to the big leagues. I mean, you know, they're big leagues. You know, as a matter of fact, because, you know, you go straight there, but they aren't good players.
That's a big difference, though. That's a big difference. Kwame Brown, who was Michael Jordan's number one pick when he was with the Wizards, he's considered a huge bust. He's played for 12 years.
Right, and you're right. But, you know, but I was going to say that's the nature of it because you step right in. I mean, he's never been a good NBA player. He's been a role player, and he's got, you know, size and athleticism don't go away, so he's a 12th man on the bench. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, it is a difference. But at the end, I mean, is Kwame Brown really that much of a better player? I mean, he's not a significantly better player in his sport than, you know, some first-round pick who gets a cup of coffee in the big leagues. I just think the guys who wash out in Double-A, you know, look worse. And again, I mean, it's the nature of the sport. You're projecting these guys down the road. And I think that's the answer to your question, too. The reason these guys don't make it is, one, professional sports are difficult no matter what the sport is. I mean, even if you were a star in college or high school, in any sport, you know, so is pretty much everybody in the NBA or NFL or Major League Baseball. So not everybody's going to continue to progress at that rate. And two, you know, like I was alluding to before, when I'm drafting guys in baseball, I'm not drafting guys who are big league ready. I'm drafting an 18-year-old and trying to think what he's going to be like when he's 23. You know, I'm drafting a college player thinking what he's going to be like 3 years down the road. Whereas in the NFL and NBA, I mean, you are doing some projection, but at the same time, you know, the guys, you know, much closer to the I guess level of competition he's, you know, at the top level, so you're not projecting him as far. So I just think it goes with you have to project these guys so much deeper than you do in other sports.
Do you ever find that scouts or front office executives try to hype up a player to you to try and increase his trade value?
No. I think when I started working 25 years ago, and I was telling you there was much less media and none of this instantaneous reporting, you maybe see some of that, but I mean the thing is when we report on prospects, it's not like we're just, you know, like if, you know, we pick Jerickson Profar from the Rangers, might be the best prospect in the minors right now. It's not like we just call the Rangers and say, hey, tell us about Jerickson Profar. I mean, we talk to, you know, I mean, a number of, you know, other teams and scouts with other teams about him. I mean, you know, we write about Jerickson Profar in our prospect handbook in the offseason. I'd venture to say that, you know, we'll probably have talked to 10 or 12 people outside the organization about Jerickson Profar. So, no, I mean, I think teams that it's nice. We've been around long enough, and we have a pretty – it's nice. I mean, we get accorded – it still surprises me even now. I mean, we get a lot of access and a lot of respect – you know, to the scouting and player development side of the game. And I think people know that if they tried to do that, we'd figure it out. You know, if somebody said, hey, this guy's throwing 95, and he's really throwing 91, we have other information that says he's throwing 91, and we'd be like, what are you talking about? So no, I don't really think that happens.
You've been listening to Jim Callis. Jim is the executive editor at Baseball America. You can give Jim a follow on Twitter at JimCallisBA. Jim, thanks so much for taking the time to join the podcast today.
No problem, Ross. I enjoy talking draft. I can talk draft all day if you let me.
All right, good stuff out of Jim Callis right there. Really enjoyed that conversation. Hope you enjoyed listening to it as well. You can again give Jim a follow on Twitter at JimCallisBA and check out his stuff all over Baseball America. You can subscribe to Baseball America. They also have some free content on their site as well. Want to thank a few more people before I wrap things up entirely. Want to thank my friend Zach Milliken. Zach is a graphics designer who was instrumental in helping me launch my websites, rosscarey.com and replacementlevelpodcast.com. He continues to help with some of the day-to-day maintenance and overall look and feel of the sites. So if you're interested in graphics design or in web design, you're looking for someone to follow on Twitter, you can give Zach a follow at ZachDM, ZACKDM, and check out his websites, paintedx.com and designtypes.tv. Also want to thank two bands for letting me use their music. Thanks to Baker for letting me use their song Reputation in the opening theme. And thanks to Scamper for letting me use their song Barcelona, which is playing right now. You can find out more information on both of those bands on MySpace Music. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Replacement Level Podcast. I'm Ross Carey. I'll have a new episode up soon.